Right, I believe that should be me live then. I suppose hello to those that have showed up, and the usual crowd of folk who are members and donate to the Streamlabs and whatever else, because otherwise the it becomes harder to actually justify doing this with both my own and Scrump's time, to be quite frank. seems there's people in the chat now. I just hope, hopefully it sounds all right. It's kind of harder to work out if you're doing that yourself. So I'm hoping chat's going to tell me in the near future if it sounds like crap, or more crap than it normally would anyway. The stream today, I'm looking at go over the first part of one of the chapters in Hoppe's The Great Fiction, which is one of the books we referenced last week and have been referencing continuously amongst the Democratization series. And I don't know, I thought I would spice it up a little bit with a sort of imagery of Hoppe. The audio seems to be a drip, fair enough. I thought I would spice it up a little bit about Hoppe giving a quick left to Pinker on the right there. I don't know, I found that a lot more entertaining than I thought I would. But the essay itself starts off with a very sort of brief summation of Hoppe's essentially asking what would constitute to him a worthy historical narrative, hence the name as is referenced in below, the libertarian quest for a grand historical narrative, which can be found in on Mises.org as always. I believe it's page. Wanted 2 seconds. Yeah, you can find the chapter in there. I believe it's page 487 in the PDF. Gonna look over the first half today, as I said, which is has more setting out of a framework, so that next week, his response to one of Pinker's main works, Our Better Angels, I think it's referred to as, from 2011, which is used not frequently, but is a lot of the base work for where many of the people we would maybe consider IDW types, or the almost the continuation of Sam Harris or a Christopher Hitchens style kind of liberalism comes from, where we there is a complete and utter ignorance of liberalism under God as a tradition that it came through, and liberalism just under man, which become a more obvious sort of distinction as we read on. But yes, it is also a very spicy quotation and makes you think about some certain big events and whether or not, anything about them, from any narrative is ever actually true. Anyway, it's quite a bit here, so I'll start. It is no secret that I am not a Hayekian. Still, I consider Hayek a great economist. Not in the same league as Mises, but few, if any, economists are. I mean, that's kind of unfair. Could I compare anyone to Mises? Hayek's frame in the public mind, however, has less to do with his economic writings, but stems largely from his writings in political theory, and it is in this area that I consider him mostly deficient. Not even his system of definitions here is internally consistent. His excursions into the field of epistemology are quite ingenious, yet here also falls short of the accomplishments of his teacher Mises. Nonetheless, owing to his wide-ranging interdisciplinary oeuvre, which contains a treasure trove of key insights into many issues, I consider Hayek one of the 20th century's outstanding intellectuals writing in the social sciences. I think somewhere else in The Great Fiction, I can't remember the chapter title right now, but there is a response and a sort of discussion that Hoppe almost sort of has with Hayek's writing about concepts of rationality and what properly constitutes rationalism. Which I suppose is a big issue in itself that would lead into this, but I think that's maybe an issue to touch on another day. It continues on. As a reflection of this esteem, Hayek was also quoted in the programmatic statement of the Property and Freedom Society. We must make the building of a free society once more an intellectual adventure, a deed of courage. What we lack is a liberal utopia, a programme which seems neither a mere defence of things as they are, nor a diluted kind of socialism, but a truly liberal radicalism, which does not spare the susceptibilities of the mighty, which is not too severely practical, and which does not confine itself to what appears today as politically possible. We need intellectual leaders who are prepared to resist the blandishments of power and influence and who are willing to work for an ideal, however small may be the prospects of its early realisation. They must be men who are willing to stick to principles and to fight for their full realisation, however remote, unless we can make the philosophical foundations of a free society once more a living intellectual issue, and its implementation a task which challenges the ingenuity and imagination of our liveliest minds. The prospects of freedom are indeed dark, but if we can regain that belief in the power of ideas which was the mark of liberalism at its best, the battle is not lost. Which is the whole issue that I think Hoppe in large part and Rothbard in his later careers sort of revolved themselves around, which was the construction of liberalism as something bigger than just, oh, well, they're just a silly set of ideas from 1700s that don't matter anymore. And also trying to distinguish it from neoliberalism and the sort of large think tanks that we see nowadays. I mean, at the time, we can look back on Rothbard essentially being excised from the Cato Institute, which is now thought of as a big liberal/libertarian institute, yet it essentially touts mainstream points. The same can be said for Fee and Reason as well. These all perform the role of justifying the regime, not talking about liberalism. They just happen to use liberalism to justify the regime. Hayek, of course, did not follow his own advice, but ended up in his political philosophy with a mishmash full of internally inconsistent compromises. Yet this does not mean that his plea for an uncompromising intellectual radicalism, which has been the purpose and hallmark of the PFS, is not worthwhile or correct. This shall not be my topic here. Rather, I want to speak about another important, if you will, complementary insight of Hayek's that can be found in the introduction he wrote for the collection of essays gathered in Capitalism and the Historians. Here, Hayek makes the point that although uncompromising intellectual radicalism is necessary as a source of energy, an inspiration for the leaders of a liberal libertarian movement, this is not sufficient to make for public appeal, because the general public is not used to or capable of abstract reasoning, high theory and intellectual consistency, but forms its political views and convictions on the basis of historical narratives, i.e. of prevailing interpretations of past events. It is upon those who want to change things for a better liberal libertarian future to challenge and correct such interpretations and propose and promote alternative revisionist historical narratives. And that's a very key point from a lot of what we could think of as the elite theory that has been looked over. Is that there is this inequality of information, and it is this inequality of information that Kuhnelt Leyden also had to recognise. He suggests that this is by this nature that you can never have democracy, for the populace will always be a mass that cannot understand the very way in which the society is structured. It's only for a small number of people to be capable of doing that. Hence why, the value of a quote-unquote consistent ideology, no matter how liberal or libertarian it is, isn't worth anything to the average person, because they haven't even begun to read into or look into ideas or care about them enough to want to even appeal to something that's a consistent quote-unquote ideologies. Libertarians. This is GF Garapay in the chat. But that just is a very interesting point. It's one that puts Hayek, as much as he wasn't perfect, outside of, as much as it talks about liberal utopia previously, outside of what we could refer to as utopian liberal thinkers. He recognises that men are not equal, which is such an important point to think about. Let me quote Hayek to this effect. While the events of the past are the source of the experience of the human race, their opinions are determined not by objective facts, but by records and interpretations to which they have access. Historical myth have perhaps played nearly as great a role in shaping opinion as historical facts, I would probably say more so. The influence which the writers of history thus exercise on public opinion is probably more immediate and extensive than that of political theorists who launch new ideas. It seems as though even such new ideas reach wider circles, usually not in their abstract form but as the interpretations of particular events. The historian, in this respect at least, one step nearer to direct power over public opinion than is the theorist. Most people, when being told that their political convictions have been affected by particular views on economic history, will answer that they have never been interested in it and have never read a book on the subject. This, however, does not mean that they do not, with the rest, regard as established facts many of the legends which at one time or another have been given currency by writers on economic history. I mean, this is a very obvious point from the sort of angle that, again, Mises and then further Hoppe talks from, is that you have to be conscious that the very economic records that you may be looking through have ultimately been collated by someone who is possibly a Marxist or a Trotskyist or some kind of syndicalist. And therefore there was a skew within all of that to paint the labour movement or the proletariat or whatever the given class to be elevated as, you know, a positive spin in that narrative. So that the record, as much as it looks like a record, is ultimately trying to tell you a story and a myth that's not just giving you facts. And you can see this again in Rothbard. The Rothbard that people are most familiar with is not Man, Economy, and State. It's the Great Depression. It's him writing about, you know, Wall Street. It's him writing about the myth of American cronyism. It's him essentially setting the historical record straight as far as someone who's following the Austrian theory would consider. And that strong concrete version of Austrian theory and its values was so integral to then creating the correct record and actually demonstrating the appropriate facts from history as far as Rothbard was concerned. I mean, you can't show everyone every single piece of economic data from 1800 to 1900 and expect them to make some kind of conclusion about it. This would be sort of absurd. You know, this is the very economic problem in the first place. There is so much economic data that one person cannot be the arbiter of it all. There has to be action in and of itself so that the whole system can operate. The central theme of capitalism in the historians is the revision of the still popular myth that it was the system of free market capitalism and the beginning of the so-called industrial revolution. So-called. Fantastic. So-called industrial revolution around the early 1800s, which has been responsible for the economic misery that caused even little children to have work for 16 hours or more under atrocious conditions in mines or similarly uncomfortable workplaces. And it was only due to the pressure of labour unions and government intervention in the economy by way of so-called social policy, a measure that this inhumane system of capital exploitation was gradually overcome and improved. When first hearing this sad story, one should think that the immediate question coming to mind should be, why would any parent subject his child to such treatment and hand him over to some evil capitalist exploiters? Did his children have a jolly good time before strolling around in meadows and fields, healthy with red cheeks, picking flowers, eating apples off the tree, fishing and swimming in creeks, rivers and lakes, playing with their toys and attentively listening to their grandparents' tales? In that case, what horrible people must these parents have been? Merely asking these questions should be sufficient to realise that this story cannot be true, and in fact, as Hayek and his collaborators demonstrated, is just about the opposite of the truth. Until the Industrial Revolution, England and the rest of the world for thousands of years had lived under Malthusian conditions. This is another concept that comes through Rothbard's History of Economics. He discusses for a while this dynamic that exists between certain economic thinkers, say from the scholastic period through to early Victorian era, where they try and discern whether or not population and total population numbers is restricted by human activity itself or the ability to grow food. And there is a number of other theories around this, but they ultimately boil down to whether or not you believe human growth was limited by the conditions of resources or by some other sort of socially constructed measure or whatever that may be. I mean, there's obviously the point in there, but the division of labour. which I think a few of the people at the time bring up in a sort of roundabout way. The general notion is there that, that is the supply of consumer goods provided by nature and by human production through means of intermediate tools and producer goods was not sufficient to ensure the survival of a growing population. Population growth exceeded the growth of production and in any increases in productivity, hence, not only in England, but anywhere, an excess of population regularly had to die off due to malnutrition, ill health, and ultimately starvation. It was only with and since the Industrial Revolution that this situation fundamentally changed. The Malthusian trap was successfully overcome, first in England, then in continental Europe, and the European overseas dependencies, finally also much of the rest of the world, so as to allow not only for a steadily growing population, but one with continuously rising material standards of living. And this momentous achievement was a result of free market capitalism, or more precisely, a combination interplay of three factors. For one, the general security of private property. Second, low time preference, i.e., the ability and willingness of a group of not a growing number of people to delay immediate gratification so as to save for the future and accumulate an even larger stock of capital goods. And third, the intelligence and ingenuity of a sufficient number of people to invent and engineer a steady stream of new productivity-enhancing tools and machines. I mean, the question then should instantly arise of what is it that brings about these three conditions? Why is it that their importance is so? And it sort of relates back again to what you see from the IDW types, is that they may play sort of positives to this idea of, oh, the free market, oh, look what how good the Industrial Revolution is, but the focus on aspects purely of human capital or very sort of consequential elements. They don't narrowly focus in the way Hoppe does here of, private property as a functioning element of society and henceforth civilization. Not just that, the associated population alongside those property rights that you would need in order to have them. That actually respect property and respect their fellow person's property, because otherwise you can't have that sort of mutual system. The parents of poor children who handed them over to the evil capitalists during the Industrial Revolution were not bad parents then, but like most parents everywhere who want the best for their children, they chose to do so because they preferred their children alive, even if it was a miserable life, rather than dead. Contrary to still popular myth in leftist circles then, capitalism did not cause misery, but literally saved countless millions of people from death by starvation and gradually lifted them from their previous state of abject poverty. Labour unions and government's so-called social policies did not help in this regard, but hampered and retarded this process of gradual economic improvement, and were still, and still are, responsible for countless numbers of necessary deaths. I mean, this is the more common phenomena of this is the sort of humanist arguments you get against sweatshops and workhouses in developing countries, which are ultimately the only way to allow children to generate an economic income that isn't just pure subsistence farming income, making like mud bricks or something like that. They are actually engaging in some constructive work as part of a much more complex production cycle that allows them to create, a much greater profit for themselves. Even if it is only £1.50 a day, it's a lot more than the 15 pence a day they might have equivalently been making by grinding corn or whatever horrendous agricultural sort of not even, the wrong word, sorry, job they may have had. There are many other related myths, equally or even more absurd, propagated by, to use Nicholas Taleb's label, bad choice, personal label, to be honest, intellectuals, yet idiots, and widely believed by the general public that you can legislate greater economic price prosperity by simply passing minimum wage laws, or else that economic misery can be overcome by simply increasing monetary spending. But why then not legislate hourly wage rates of $100 or $1,000? And why then is India, for instance, still a poor country? Are the ruling elites in India too dumb to know about this magic formula? Why then, since everywhere nowadays governments can easily increase the quantity of paper money in practically unlimited amounts, is there still any poor person around? mean, I'm kind of glad that I've actually, I don't see people discussing the whole minimum wage thing anymore. It's just, it's stated fact, minimum wage bad, move on. I do enjoy the fact that that must be some sign of development within our circles, that that is now a non-issue. People don't discuss it anymore. Nor are such faulty historical narratives restricted only to economic history. Rather, much of what we have learned is the established truth from our standard history books about World War I and World War II, about the American and the French revolutions, about Hitler, Churchill, FDR, and Napoleon, and on and on and on and on, also turns out to be faulty history. Facts mixed in, whether intentionally or not, with hefty doses of fiction and fake. I mean, you know, some of the events he's mentioned there are some of the very ones we focused on through democratization. I mean, this quest that he's asking people to go on is one that we have sort of consequently taken up. And it's one of the things I think that made me think about it and drive through that series in a more full-on and sort of a deep look. Because ultimately, it needs to be done. It's one of those things that must be done. We must have the corrected record of reasons why certain events in World War I and World War II actually happened. We can't just deal with, you know, this accidental theory of history that, oh well, everyone in Europe was just angry at each other, so they just had a big war. You know, it's not conducive to creating any form of effective worldview if that's your starting off point. If anything, propagating such a worldview is you helping to mentally sort of nullify the populace by just engaging them in absolutely uncritical thought. I mean, there's also the point here that he talks about whether, you know, also turns out to be faulty history, facts mixed in, whether intentionally or not. It's a sort of interesting point from Malula, actually, that the more truth you can have within your propaganda, no matter how much you spin it, the more facts that are in there, the easier it is to play it off as the truth. You know, you don't want to have to head at home and have three solid facts that show up your case and that's it. If you can have dozens and dozens of stuff and bombard people time and time again, and then only focus on specific elements, or only use one very specific and stringent narrative to tie those elements together, it is a much more effective technique than just lying or making it up. Important as the revision of all these myths is, however, the greatest challenge for libertarians, whether economic or otherwise, is to develop a grand historical narrative that is to counter and correct so-called Whig theory of history that all ruling elites everywhere and at all times have tried to sell to the public. That is the view that we live in the best of all times, and that they are the ones who will guarantee that this stays so, and that the grand sweep of history, notwithstanding some ups and downs, has been one or more less steady progress. I mean, there's an interesting point here. He's essentially suggesting, and for the most part, that we should attack what is the progressive historical narrative, or the Marxist material narrative of history, which modern liberalism, because it is no longer tied to God, finds itself subsumed in, because it can only appeal to material progress, and material progress is the very goal of so much of Marxism. However, he sort of carries this on by referring it to purely as the Whig theory that has existed at all times, and I'm not necessarily sure if that's true. I mean, if he wants to then use Whig theory as an interchangeable term for all political formulas, then I suppose that's technically true, but there is less so the doctrine of progressivism as we know in that part. The Whig theory of history, despite some setbacks, and motivated in particular by the experience of the two disastrous world wars during the first half of the 20th century, has again become predominant in the public mind, as indicated by the success of such books as Francis Fukuyama's The End of History and The Last Man, or still more recently, Steven Pinker's The Better Angels of Our Nature and Enlightenment Now. The first Pinker work there being the one that will be rebuked later next week. I do think he misses a point here with the two world wars, though. For me, as far as I am aware, the two world wars seems to be the sort of consolidation point. You know, we constantly talk about 1945 as a year zero, and I think that's still very much the case. There is still also the kind of year zero of the French Revolution, which is very valid in a lot of ways, but that myth, the first people to be born and the total absorption of that myth across society, where the people born after 1945, there was almost no element of what was attacked by the French Revolution left in the world by the time that you get there. So that the progressive arc of history takes a turn at 1945 because finally it no longer has any enemies left in the most pure sense. According to the proponents of this theory, what makes the present age so great and qualifies it as the best of all times is the combination of two factors. For one, never before in human history have technology and the natural sciences reached this high a level of development and have the average material living standards been as high as today, which appears essentially correct, and which fact without doubt contributes greatly to the public appeal and acceptance of a Whig theory. And this sounds, on the face of it, like quite a tautologist point, but there's two sort of things being described here. There is one, the Whig theory, sort of assuming its ownership of the successes of previous societies, which it ultimately denounces anyways, we'll see later on. It harks back to ideas that do come from the Middle Ages and do come from scholastic theory written in an era of what we recognise now as feudalism. Yet it throws all of that away when it needs to call that illiberal. And that furthermore, in the same way that Kaczynski discusses in regards to technology, he says that it was only the mere coincidence that America was democratic that then the virtue of democracy could be argued through the victory of World War I and World War II. That same argument might not exist. And as far as he was concerned, in a sense, if Germany or Russia had become the dominant global power in that era, we would have seen a sort of some kind of different form of material progressivism, possibly, either one of a slightly fascist tone or a communistic tone, which is ultimately the very small differences between them, but at least the we can recognize them by the different labels, and whatever gets labeled as capitalism is labeled as that which succeeded over all the other prevailing societies, so it gets to hold onto this credence. Whether it actually correlates to its victory in those wars at all or not is a completely different question. Secondly, never before in history have people supposedly experienced as much freedom as today with the development of liberal democracy or democratic capitalism, which claim, despite its widespread popularity, I consider a historical myth. In fact, since the degree of freedom and of economic and technological development are indeed positively correlated, this leads me to the conclusion average material living standards would have been even higher than they presently are if history had only taken a different course. Again, I'm not entirely sure if this is the case. I think there is a lot to be said for necessity is the mother of invention, and it is just again a almost Hoppe kind of slightly falling for his own point here. That the just because the technology is there, he's then looking back on it slightly empirically and suggesting that that's the case. And I don't think that's necessarily true. I mean, we're seeing rapid technological development, or what we are told is rapid technological development, in the last 2 to 5 years. And I don't think there is a single person that would say that economic freedom hasn't been lessened in that time period, but yet technological development has also increased. So unless there's, Hoppe is trying to suggest that we would have cracked fusion energy and all these other, essentially impossible tasks. It seems to me that at a later point he goes on to mention the sort of technology not really being a worthwhile measure, so I don't really understand why he has it here, but I suppose there it is. No one can be perfect. And yes, the point someone's making in the chat there, the Enlightenment era absolute monarchy certainly helped set the groundwork for managerialism. Well, of course that's the case. I mean, that's again mentioned prior in this, but that's maybe sort of the I think what would it be? There's one of the Louis in France that's always quoted as one of the most absolute monarchists. And he's the model that's followed by Napoleon, and in a certain sense, all democratic or republican governments since that era have tried to follow along in that model by being a sort of total institution. Before offering an alternative, grand, revisionist historical narrative and indicating where Pinker and his ilk go off the rails with their Whiggish world history, a few remarks on the history of science are in order. Until relatively recently, the belief in a steady growth of science, if nothing else, has never been in much doubt. Until the early 1960s, with historians of science Thomas Kuhn and the book The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, there's another one Rothbard was a big fan of that appears a lot in his Austrian economics. Assume perspective in economic history, sorry. Kuhn, in contrast to the orthodox Whiggish view on the matter, portrayed the development of science not so much as a continuous march upward into the light, but rather as a sequence of paradigm shifts that followed each other, much like directionless one-lady fashion follows one another. This book became a huge success, and for quite some time, Kuhn's view became a widespread fashion in philosophical circles. Kuhn, notwithstanding, however, I still regard the traditional view concerning the development of science as essentially correct. The central error of Kuhn, as well as of many philosophers of science, revealingly expressed again and again, for instance, by Sheldon Cooper, the super science nerd theoretical physicist character in the hugely popular TV series The Big Bang Theory, lies in a fundamental misconception regarding the interrelation between science on the one hand and engineering on or technology on the other. It's a shame that we have such a corrupted and fallen culture, and we live in such dense ashes that we have to force Hoppe into referencing the Big Bang Theory and Sheldon Cooper so that he has references to the Bugman. This is one of the reasons why you should be anti-Bugman, purely so we don't have to even think about him anymore. That in and of itself is torturous. This is the popular misconception of science as coming before, having priority over, and assuming a higher rank and dignity vis-à-vis engineering and technology as only secondary and inferior intellectual enterprises, i.e., as mere applied sciences. In fact, however, matters are exactly the other way round. What comes methodologically first and what makes science as we know it at all possible, and at the same time provides its ultimate foundation, is human engineering and construction. Put plainly and bluntly, without such purposely designed and constructed instruments as measuring rods, clocks, planes, rectangles, scales, counters, lenses, microscopes, telescopes, audiometers, thermometers, spectrometers, X-ray and ultrasound machines, particle accelerators, and on and on and on, no empirical and experimental science as we know would be possible. Or to put it in the words of the great late German philosopher scientist Peter Janich, handwork comes before and provides the stable foundation and groundwork of mundwerk. Whatever controversies or quibbles scientists may have, they are always controversies and quibbles within a stable operational framework, a reference system defined by a given state of technology. And in the field of human engineering, no one would ever throw out or falsify a working instrument until and unless he had another better working instrument available. And this is, I think, an amazing point here, and it's one of those ones that you only really get as you start getting into the very ironically conceptual aspects of a lot of Austrian economics. But the simplest way I could explain it is that the handwork of actually trading must be done before you can come up with the mundwerk of economic theory. You cannot study a phenomena that does not exist. And this becomes a very big problem for a lot of modern social science because they are studying a lot of things that we can only really suggest might have happened or maybe happened here, but if this thing isn't true, then no, it didn't happen. And as much as he says it would be absurd to throw out an instrument that was working perfectly well, in that same vein, it would also be absurd to use an instrument that measured something that wasn't real. And this anyone who understands subjective value theory and the I think it would be the interpersonal comparison of utility problem that is apparent in almost all mainstream economics understand that this is, you know, they are putting the mund work before the hand work, as it were. This is, you know, a big issue with a lot of modern science teaching. It is very abstract. There is no practical work that goes hand in hand with it. You do not learn physics as you learn engineering, not, you know, as you should at least, never mind actually engaging with engineering materials in your own hands and then coming to the process of thinking about them, you know, actually learning how to develop the instruments that would be required to turn that handwork into mund work. Hence, it is engineering and advances in engineering that, oh, sorry, wait, I skipped a little bit there. No. Hence, it is engineering and advances in engineering that make science and scientific progress possible. At the same time, prevent from happening that which Karl Popper's falsification of philosophy science currently dominates public opinion must always or must admit is always possible. Not only scientific regression, but the complete breakdown of our entire system of knowledge due to the supposedly always possible falsification of even its seemingly most basic hypothesis. What prevents this nightmare from happening and what exposes both Kuhn's relativism and Popper's related falsificationism as involving an elementary methodological error is the existence of handwork and its methodical priority and primacy over the mere mund work of science, which is again a much more intellectual method of it, of essentially suggesting that if you are dealing with science on its own and as something purely abstract, then maybe you can believe it's something that would be falsified out of its own existence or would disappear as textbooks disappeared. But it would be like saying that because there's no economics textbooks, there is now no economics. But somehow people didn't understand that they could trade and gain out of trading without economics textbooks. And it is that, it's these sort of historical flaws that once you start to pick at them in any sort of great narrative or grand historical narrative, as Hoppe is calling them here, especially in the terms of the Whig theory and progressivist historiography, you notice these flaws and it becomes very glaring and obvious. With this out of the way, I can now turn to the fake part of Whig theory of history, concerning social history. Although it's comparatively easy to diagnose technological progress, along with this, also scientific progress occurs whenever we learn how to successfully accomplish some additional, quicker or better result in our purposeful dealings with the non-human world of material objects, plants and animals. It is significantly more difficult to define and diagnose social problems, i.e., progress in interpersonal dealings or man-to-man interactions. When it's a very simple point of Hoppe, essentially suggesting that there is no ruler you can use to measure social ideals. You cannot measure how good society is. It's not one that's possible. And the notion of throwing GDP numbers or GDP per capita or purchasing power or the Big Mac index as some sort of measure of, you know, as he goes on to describe here, social perfection, as it were, is completely laughable. And it is only ever accepted nowadays because the belief in increased production is goes hand in hand with the belief that society is better. These two are one and the same. To do this, it is first necessary to define a model of social perfection that is in accordance with human nature, i.e., of men as they really are, which can serve as a reference system to diagnose the relative proximity or distance of various historical events, periods, and developments to this ideal. This definition of social perfection and social progress must be strictly separate, independent, and analytically distinct from the definition of technological and scientific growth and perfection, even if both progress or progress or growth dimensions are empirically positively correlated. Conceptually, that is, it must be allowed that there can be societies that are near perfect socially, but technologically backwards, as well as societies that are technologically highly advanced and yet socially backwards, which I think is a massive point of divergence from any other liberal writing. The notion that just because you know, if you go and read Pinker, I mean, if you go on his Twitter feed and you read any piece that he's discussing, or the same with someone like Lindsay or a Sam Harris, you know, they are celebrating that, oh, look, life expectancy has now reached a record new high. And that in and of itself is some celebration. That man lives an extra 2 years on average than he did a decade before. It's some achievement worth celebrating. It constitutes value in some sort of way, despite the fact that actually what happens in that time is you just live another 2 years of poor and ill health in a world that you probably can't stand anymore. The libertarian, this ideal of social perfection is peace, i.e., a normally tranquil and frictionless person-to-person interaction, and a peaceful resolution of occasional conflict within a stable framework of private or several mutually exclusive property and property rights. I do not want to appeal only to libertarians with this, however, but to a potentially universal or Catholic audience, because the same ideal of social perfection is essentially also the one prescribed by the 10 biblical commandments. Exactly, yes. It's not the years in a life, it's a life in the years. Precisely. If anything, what they do is they drain the life out of the years as they give them to you. They are literally inflating years as you're getting fiat years because they aren't worth anything. It's inflationism gone wild. But there is an interesting point here that Hoppe is, in doing so by appealing to the Bible directly, separating himself since from essentially all liberal theorists since about, I don't know, anyone born after about the 1950s anyway. I know that there was still, you know, your Isaiah Berlins of the world who possibly thought of some notion of liberalism under God, but that was very much the tail end of what Hoppe is trying to appeal to, which is the world of the sort of Middle Ages almost entirely in a certain sense. And that he's asking us to think about the mund work in a certain sense required to create that society instead of just, oh sorry, the handwork required to build that and maintain that society instead of just the mund work of thinking about a society like that, because thinking about it on its own will not bring it around. And that has to require some form of positive aspect, some form of thing that, again, that you can appeal to that isn't just, oh, well, we got a democratic mandate. It's, well, no, actually, it says this in the Bible and the commandments, so by God's word to you, you're not correct. To have this absolutist aspect is much more important in terms of a theory that you're appealing to the common man, because you can't then just turn around and say, well, oh, that's guff, I don't believe in that. Because in a certain sense, if you were to really ask people whether or not they believe in God, it'd be very hard to come up with a concrete answer and appeal against your absolute in this sense. Setting the first four commandments aside, which refer to our relation to God as the one and only ultimate moral authority and final judge of our earthly conduct, and the proper celebration of the Sabbath, the rest referring to worldly affairs, display a deep and profoundly libertarian spirit. I just wish they'd stick the first two or three in there and just go whole hog on the fact that man is not free. And it's okay and very well that he's sort of, as we will get into, channeling Carlyle. I think it would be better if he was to go whole hog and channel Robert Filmer and go full 15th century. Bring back the patriarchy and whatever have you. Number five. Honour your father and your mother, as the Lord your God has commanded you, that your days may be long and it may be well with you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbour. You shall not covet your neighbour's wife, and you shall not desire your neighbour's house, his field, his male servant, his female servant, his ox, his donkey, or anything that is your neighbour's. Some libertarians may argue that not all of these commandments have the same rank or status. They may point out, for instance, that the fifth and the seventh commandments are not on a par with the same dignity as the sixth and the eighth and the tenth commandments. That this may also be the case with commandment nine, prohibiting libel or that desiring another's wife or servant is not a par with coveting his house or field. However, the Ten Commandments do not say anything about the severity and suitable punishment of violations of its various commands. They prescribe all mentioned activities and desires, but they leave open the question of how severely any of them deserves to be punished. In this, the biblical commandments go above and beyond what many libertarians regard as sufficient for the establishment of a peaceful social order. The mere strict adherence to commandments 6, 8, and 10, yet this difference between a strict and rigid libertarianism and the 10 biblical commandments does not imply any incompatibility between the two. Both are in complete harmony, only a distinction is made between legal prohibitions on the one hand, expressed in Commandments 6, 8, and 10, violations of which may be punished by the exercise of physical violence and extra legal or moral prohibitions on the other hand, expressed in Commandments 5, 7, and 9, violations of which may be punished only by means below the threshold of physical violence, such as social disapproval, discrimination, exclusion, or ostracism. Indeed, thus interpreted, the full six mentioned commandments can be recognised as even and important over a strict and rigid libertarianism, given the common shared goal of social perfection of a stable, just and peaceful social order. I mean, again, the noticeable separation from both standard libertarianism and modern IDW-style neoliberalism is the express sort of statement that moral crimes do exist and they come with them with punishments. You cannot get away with these things and they must be held accountable, even though they may in some way not go against the hardcore libertarian ethics of the NAP. They must still be recognised as things which are not desirable or ideal within a society. For any society of people who habitually disrespect their parents and routinely mock the idea of natural ranks and hierarchies of social authority which underlies the institution of the family, who poo-poo the institution of marriage and cavalierly regard adultery as inconsequential, faultless or even liberating, or who habitually scoff at the idea of personal honour and honesty and routinely or even gleefully engage in libelous activity, i.e. the practice of bearing false witness against one's neighbour. Any such society will quickly disintegrate into a group of people ceaselessly disturbed by social strife and conflict rather than enjoying an enduring lasting peace. I don't know if this sounds familiar to anyone else when it comes to the concept of a high trust society, one in which that notion of the very Christian ethic of, you know, do unto others as you would have done unto yourself, where that is actually recognised, and how important a moral lesson that is for a large number of people, that they don't fully grasp that. They think that because they support progress, because they support that which is good in their grand historical narrative, that they can get away with, or are not even aware that the way they actually engage in the world is somewhat asymmetric, and they do, you know, they do bear false witness against someone's neighbour, they do covet another man's goods. Yeah, and doing so they feel justified. And it is that, again, these faulty notions of science that allow those beliefs to propagate, that give off such a justification. But there was the further point here as well, that to enjoy the very, if I quickly scroll, to enjoy the very freedoms of 10, 6, and 8, which are supposed to be the simple ones, you need 5, 7, and 9. And because, you know, 5, 7, and 9, again, is the handwork to the mund work that gives you the world within which people do not covet each other's goods. You know, you must live as good people if you want a good society, which is not a point that's really made often enough, despite the tones that are constantly played off to what we think of as a good society, or striving for the good society. It is never put upon us to actually believe something authentic in the course of that. For surely, Taking this biblical libertarian ideal of social perfection as a benchmark, then, the next step in our argument must be the diagnosis, i.e. the comparative evaluation and ranking of various historical periods and developments regarding their relative proximity or distance to this ultimate ideal goal. In this regard, immediately a first diagnosis concerning the contemporary world impresses itself, even if we may grant that the dominant Western modern model of liberal democracy or democratic capitalism comes closer to the ideal than the models of social organisation presently followed elsewhere, outside the so-called Western world, it still falls glaringly short of the ideal. Indeed, it explicitly and unequivocally contradicts and violates the Catholic biblical commandments. And the proponents and promoters of this model then manifestly, even if not admittedly, deny and oppose God's will and turn out advocates of the devil instead. For one, even the greatest intellectual contortions, it is impossible to derive the institution of a state from these commandments. If no one may steal, murder, or desire another person's property, then no institution that may steal, murder, and desire another person's property can ever be permitted to coming into existence. Not so entirely sure about that point, but we shall continue on anyway. Yet like all other societies today, all present Western societies are societies with states, which may routinely steal, tax, murder, go to war, and covet other people's property, legislate. Moreover, in Western democratic state societies in particular, the moral sin of desiring another man's property is not only not strictly and universally outlawed, but routinely put into practice. This sin is actually promoted and cultivated to its utmost devilish extreme. With democratic elections installed as the centrepiece of social life, everyone is liberated from God's commandment and made free to desire whatever he wants of the property of others, and to express his immoral desire through regular anonymous votes. And this is Hopper essentially not admitting it, but those further points about God being supreme in the commandments actually were important, because in that mythical sense that the common man understands things is the only way that this point here then makes sense. You know, it's only from the view of someone who understands the common man's behaviour that one can understand you leaving the regime of God and some kind of whatever institution guarantees that to being handed into the devil, essentially. I mean, this is the point Carlyle makes time and time again about democracy and people being taken out of the hands of the king and the local lords and whoever else, is that they were now, you know, they are liberated unto the devil, as he would say. Surely this liberal democratic model of social organisation cannot be the end of history, neither for a libertarian nor anyone taking the biblical commandments to heart. Indeed, Fukuyama's 1992 claim to the contrary borders on the blasphemous. Regardless of how disastrous the diagnosis of contemporary modern world turns out to be, however, it might still be the case that the present state of affairs represents some sort of progress. It might not be the end of history, but it might be a closer approximation to the goal of social perfection than anything historically preceding it. To refute the Whig theory of history in its entirety, then, it is further necessary to identify some earlier, and thus naturally technologically less advanced, society that adhered more closely to the biblical commandments and came nearer to social perfection. And so as to carry any weight in public debate in the battle of rival historical narratives, the counterexample in question should be a big one. That is, it should not only be a short time span, or it should not be only a short time span in some tiny place, but a large-scale and long-lasting historical phenomenon. And for the same reason of potential popular appeal, the example should be connected both geographically and genealogically as a historical predecessor to the contemporary Western model of democratic state societies. And it should not lie too far in the dark and distant past. It's not the end of the world, but you can see it from here. But all I can see is the new beginnings, I'm afraid. I do not see no end. In my own attempts at offering a revisionist account of Western history, in particular my two books, Democracy, the God That Failed, and A Short History of Man, I have identified that the European Middle Ages, or what's sometimes also and better referred to as Latin Christendom, the roughly 1,000-year period from the fall of Rome until the late 16th or early 17th century, is such an example. Not perfect in many ways, but closer to the ideal of social perfection than anything that followed it, and in particular, closer than the present democratic order. I mean, there's a very, I think the. He goes on to talk about the Middle Ages here, which is ultimately the period he's wanting to discuss. If anyone wants a good example or a good writing from that, there is Thomas Carlyle's book Past and Present, within which the second portion is called The Monk, which is him writing at length and almost kind of romanticising the life of a monk in St. Edmundsbury in the 12th century, I think. And it's very, and Elements is very twee, and it's very, written under what God, what Hopper goes on to refer to as a God-pleasing and God-fearing people. But it is very different from what we live in now, and noticeably so. And that the things back then that would seem like norms are nowadays what would seem completely alien to us. And it, again, ironically enough, it is those norms all the way back then in some developing sort of fashion produced the very liberal ideology we have now today. So, to Hopper's point, it's why can we not connect that to something that replicates it now in its 12th century form, or at least take lessons from that form of, liberalism as it existed, not liberalism as we quote unquote understood it. Well, it's particularly unfavourable treatment of the Middle Ages. Because as many historians, or sorry, is that the right? Apparently the wrong one, sorry. Not surprisingly, this is also the very period in Western history that our current godless democratic rulers and their court historians have chosen to portray in the darkest of terms. In Greek and Roman society, they can see some good and value, even if it supposedly lags far behind the level of social advancement reached with a contemporary democratic social order. The Middle Ages are routinely portrayed as dark, cruel, and filled with superstition, best forgotten and ignored in all of standard history and historical narrative. I mean, our goal is essentially to perform this task with it, at the very least the 20th century, and probably a good bit before it and a good bit after, so that whenever anyone asks, like, what happened between like 1850 and 2050, it's just, oh, we don't talk about that. Those are the dark ages, not good times. Man was in a serious decline. Why this particularly unfavourable treatment of the Middle Ages? Because as many historians, old and contemporary, have of course noticed too, the Middle Ages represents a large-scale and long-lasting historical example of a stateless society, and as such represents the polar opposite of the present status social order. Indeed, in the Middle Ages, notwithstanding its many imperfections, can be identified as a God-pleasing, a God-gefällig social order, with the present democratic state order, notwithstanding its numerous achievement, stands in constant violation of God's commandments and must be identified as a satanic order. This is again what I mean by this distinction between liberalism under God and liberalism under man. I don't think that the statist angle is purely why historians neglect this period. I think so much of the neglection comes from the fact that there was genuine and authentic belief, and that genuine authentic belief was not monopolized by the state. It was maybe arguably monopolized in pieces by the church, but even then, this is a pre-Church of England sort of age. It's the supreme authority is maybe the Pope, and even then it's his authority is not quite supreme in the same sense. And that I think that scares especially the IDW types. Genuine faith, I think, seems to put them right off, because they ultimately hark back once again to progressivism. And when it's not modern progressives, it's the progressives of the turn of the century. It's the people who focused on education and early atheist movements who genuinely saw God-fearing people as terrifying themselves. And that notion that we have talked about before, and that I mentioned the article the other day, that they saw it as some sort of virtue, it was some ideal to essentially remove God as a concept completely from man and replace it with something else. Because, of course, you can't just leave the hole unfilled. I think it's rather obvious now that doesn't work. To answer the question, then, Satan and his earthly followers will, of course, go all out to make us ignore and forget about God and belittle, besmirch, and denigrate everything and anything that shows his hand. This is all the more reason for any libertarian and God-pleasing Catholic to study and draw inspiration from the historical period of the European Middle Ages. Something incidentally made easier nowadays and likely to encounter little opposition from the powers that be in their increasingly rigorously enforced speech code of political correctness, because any such study has long since been relegated to the status of a nerdy, quaint, and exotic interest, far distant in time from the present and without any contemporary relevance. I'm not necessarily sure if that's the case. There seems to be a lot of people who write reactionary material about the Middle Ages that are not taken well in press, at the least. Maybe that's just because they're onto us now. In standard history, we are told, as a quasi-axiomatic truth, that the institution of the state is necessary and indispensable for the maintenance of social peace. The study of the Middle Ages and Latin Christendom shows that this is untrue, a historical myth. And how, for a lengthy historical period, peace was successfully maintained without a state, and thus without open renunciation of liberal and libertarian precepts. Although many libertarians fancy an anarchic social order as a largely horizontal order without hierarchies and different ranks of authority, i.e., basically all your progressive ANCAPs and your mutualist people who think that we do actually all live free. And we all just live in the homestead and no one needs to do anything else. Society just organizes itself, guys, we promise. Sorry, horizontal order without hierarchies and different banks of authority as anti-authoritarian. The medieval example of a stateless society teaches us otherwise. Peace was not maintained by the absence of hierarchies and ranks of authority, but the absence of anything but social authority and ranks of social authority. Indeed, in contrast to the present order, which essentially recognises only one authority, that of the state, the Middle Ages were characterised by a great multitude of competing, cooperating, overlapping, and hierarchically ordered ranks of social authority. And again, this is, as Hoppe talking about, one of the influences you see him in his more in-depth work is de Juvenal. And what he's describing here with these competing authorities as the secondary institutions of a foreign old world to us, because we do not have them anymore. We do not have a church that holds clout. We do not have, as he goes on to discuss here, guilds and associations. These things do not hold sway. We maybe have unions, but even then, these unions are subservient to the state. And so much of the credentialism that we have nowadays, while it consists of all these different ranks and has some aspect of authority, all these ranks and authority are all deferred and guaranteed to the state. They are not deferred and guaranteed to different authorities, to different lords, to different kings, to different courts, whoever it was. And I think it's interesting that the only place you recognise this as an individual nowadays is when you try and go through the court system to hold someone legally accountable. You must start at a lower local court and then the sheriff court and then a high court and then maybe some kind of national court. I think it's no coincidence that it's only when the individual attempts to hold the monopolistic state in account that all of a sudden it puts up all these different barriers of ranks that supposedly exist before you get to the thing that you're actually trying to hold responsible. There was the authority of the heads of family households and of various kinship groups. There were patrons, lords, overlords, feudal kings with their estates, their vassals and the vassals of vassals. There were countless different separate communities and towns and a huge variety of religious, artistic, professional and social orders, councils, assemblies, guilds, associations and clubs, each with its own rules, hierarchies and rank orders. In addition, and of utmost importance, there were the authorities of the local priest, the more distant bishop, and of the Pope in Rome. Again, this is another thing that's come up as I've been reading through Jacques Ellul. He talks about the necessity for the mass society as a prerequisite for propaganda, or total propaganda that fully forms into one, all of society trying to direct itself towards one goal or another. And that when society exists in smaller groups, local communities and fragmented guilds and these different smaller autonomous organizations as opposed to one massive organization, it becomes very difficult to institute propaganda on these people. So that if you were to, you have to, in a sense, something we also see in Francis when we've discussed him, these bourgeois institutions of the old world, these numerous different secondary institutions, must be destroyed in the process of what you could only call massification of any society. But no authority was absolute, and no one person or group of people held a monopoly on its position or rank of authority. The hierarchical feudal lord-vassal relationship, for instance, was not indissoluble. It could be broken if either side violated the provisions of the fealty oaths they both had sworn to uphold. I mean, this is just a very simple point of the fact that private contracts work, but the social contract, public contracts that people implicitly agree to are impossible. They can't be carried out. There is no way to verify that the social contract is being upheld, not just because there's so many cases to measure, but the case stated itself is normally of such an abstract fashion that instead of just some lord saying that, well, in an absolute sense, you follow my will, that's that between you and that lord, as much as it's maybe not as a friendly relationship as you in a democratic state, it is at least honest, which is such a, there's so much more for, I think, what we think now of the ancient regime, that at least throughout the entirety of its time through this feudal period, it was honest. It told you that it ruled over you. Nor was the relationship between lord and vassal a transitive one. That is, the lord of a vassal was not, on account of his lordship, also the lord of all his vassals' vassals. Indeed, such vassals could be tied to a different lord, or they could elsewhere and regarding other things be lords themselves, which precluded any involvement in their affairs in question. In a sense, they weren't the central bureaucracy. They didn't all just work for the same organization. They worked for different people who could actually be recognized within society as being responsible for the carrying out of that role of whatever it was they had to perform. Whether it was, wheat or tilling fields or looking after the water supply or shingling people's roofs, whatever it was, there was some written aspect in paper that said, Lord such and such is the person you go to if this is wrong. Instead of you just running to the government and trying to hold the whole thing to account and getting absolutely nowhere. No, but the guilds obviously do. They aren't all individual actors trading in the way that, Mises would look at this, a perfect capital economy, but as a method for preserving a top-down social order that is actually also accountable in some fashion, it has many more virtues to it than that of labour unions or working groups or whatever sort of thing we have nowadays that we use to organize ourselves amongst labor or through whatever industry. It was thus near impossible for anyone to exercise any straight top-down authority, and hence also immediately difficult in particular to raise and maintain a large standing army and engage in large-scale or even continent-wide warfare. And this is a point we discussed in the stream last Thursday with Prudentialist. You need the central state prior to, large-scale standing armies, and that this is a point even recognised by Marxists as well, who of course had their influence upon Hoppe. But the creation of a large-scale standing army is not something that society, as these differing sort of organic top-down orders that all compete and collaborate as they feel necessary. They couldn't all come together and form an army because there would be no reason to. It is only when one individual can collapse all these different sort of horizontal hierarchies into the one central horizontal hierarchy that the creation of a standing army is possible, and that the creation of a standing army is the phenomena of state, not the phenomena of natural society as we would have otherwise known it. That is, the phenomenon which we have come to regard as perfectly normal today, that a command that is directly binding on all of society is given from the top on down, from its highest ranks down to the lowliest, was absent in the Middle Ages. Authority was widely dispersed, and any one person in possession of authority was constrained and kept in check by another. Even feudal kings, bishops, and indeed even the Pope himself, could be called upon and brought to justice by other competing authorities. I mean, I think I'll even stand in defence here and go further than Hoppe and suggest that even in the time of the absolute kings that followed on from this, there is the sense that those people are still limited by the construction of society itself and by possibly to some extent the very technological limitations that they can't, you know, they can give top-down orders, but they can't rely on them actually being carried out. So they have to mediate their demands so far as people can actually are willing to do them. They have to actually play to public opinion in a way that we don't anymore, because they just legislate out not complying with the law. Oh, hello, yes. Howdy to you too. Authority was widely dispersed in any one person position, yeah, blah blah. Feudal law reflected this hierarchic, anarchic social structure of the Middle Ages. All of law was essentially private law, i.e. law applying to persons and person-to-person interactions. All of litigation was between a personal defendant and a personal plaintiff, and punishment typically involved payment of some specified material compensation by the offender to his victim or his lawful successor. However, the central characteristic of the Middle Ages as a historical model of a private law society did not mean that feudal law was some sort of a unitary, coherent, and consistent legal system. To the contrary, feudal law allowed for a great variety of locally and regionally different laws and customs, and the difference in the treatment of similar offences in different localities could be quite drastic. Yet at the same time, with the Catholic Church and the scholastic teachings of natural law, there was an overarching institutional framework and moral reference system in place to serve as a morally unifying force, constraining and moderating the range of variation between the laws of different localities. I mean, there was a number of points here which he's sort of talked around. You know, along with the standing army, you normally very quickly follow on from that with a national police force, and that the national police force has to sort of come hand in hand with a unitary and uniform law, as he's describing it, as the sort of modern system is nowadays. Instead, there was a much more organic production of justice itself. When I was discussing what must be done with Caleb Brown the other week, you know, we touched on this point that justice was, it was the business of the common man. It wasn't just the business of the church or the court or the police officer, because there wasn't any police officers at the time, so someone had to provide justice. And I'm not necessarily saying that every person played his similar role as some sort of night watchman, but that there would be people in your community who either made it their job or made it their sort of moral personal crusade to enforce justice and some form of law and order. Because as we know, you cannot have the freedom that we recognise and discuss in this sense without that law and order. And in doing so, you become much more attached to the process of justice. You're directly involved in it. This brews within you the sense of practice in regards to law and order. It doesn't become a separate thing from the day-to-day running of society. It instead becomes, you know, your very way in which you deal with that society. Needless to say, there are many imperfections that future historians to this day would focus on and highlight so as to discredit the entire period. During the Middle Ages, under the influence of Catholic Church, the institution of slavery, which had been a dominant feature of Greek and Roman society, had been increasingly discredited and pushed back to near extension. but it had not entirely disappeared. As well, the institution of serfdom from a moral point of view, better than slavery, but still not without moral blemish, was yet a widespread social phenomenon. Moreover, plenty of small-scale wars and feuds took place during the entire period, and as we never allowed to forget, the punishments dished out in various law courts for various offences here or there were sometimes, for modern sensibilities in any case, extreme, harsh and cruel. A murderer might be hung or beheaded, quartered, burnt, boiled or drowned, hopefully all at the same time. A thief might have his finger or hand cut off, and a false witness his tongue torn out, an adulteress might be stoned, a rapist castrated and a witch burnt. In short, what he's saying there is people were actually held accountable in some sense. But there's also the interesting point here, again, one of the ones that is never fully explained to you in any of liberal theory when it comes to their touchstone events of the French Revolution or the American Revolution or the American Civil War. The people that are liberated, quote-unquote, out of slavery, they're not liberated. They are taken away from their local lord, who actually had some reason to care for them, and given to the hands of a central state. And a central state that, given all the good faith by the very nature of its organisation, cannot care for that individual in the same way. It's not feasible. And it's not even necessarily a point of ideology. It's that human organisation on that scale makes it impossible to then have that interaction with the very people who supposedly decree over you. And that, again, you being involved with justice in your very community, knowing the judge, knowing the people at court, knowing the king, knowing the people from the church, it made it a much more organic and accountable process than any amount of legislation or human rights measures, or the UNCHR charter, this, that, or the next thing, which are the things the IDW, the things that neoliberalism holds up as these hallmarks of the good society, ultimately guarantee nothing. They just exist as, if anything, a way to make sure that courts don't hamstring themselves and know what rules to play by. That an accountant for that, you cannot account in the same way for the organic understanding of human behaviour that happened in these much smaller communities that had been around for, you know, some of this period of the Middle Ages he's discussing here is 2 to 3 times longer than the, maybe probably at least 2 times longer than the existence of the very United States. So it is no wonder that it had such a lasting sort of solid nature to it. Yes, accountable to people, not entities or paper. Yes, because accountability does not exist in bits of paper. It does not exist in silicon chips. It exists in your ability to actually hold someone to account, maybe even if that is by your own hands in a literal sense. It's these features in particular we are told in standard history to associate with the Middle Ages, so as to arouse our moral indignation and feel elated about our own enlightened present. Even if all true, however, any such exclusive concentration on these features as a distinctive characteristic of Middle Ages is to miss the mark, or the wood for the trees, as it were. It takes accident for nature and what is natural and normal, that is, it ignores, whether deliberate or not, the central characteristic of the entire period. The fact that it was a stateless social order with widely dispersed, hierarchically ordered and rivaling centres of authority, and this focus then conveniently closes the eyes of the fact that the excesses of the Middle Ages actually pale in comparison to those of the present democratic state order. For surely slavery and serfdom have not disappeared in the democratic world. But he's true here. In the same way that there is that association with democracy being the thing that won World War II, it is this ill treatment of criminals in the Middle Ages that defined it as such a bad thing, and that there is actually possibly no correlation between this whatsoever, as he's going to continue on here. The sort of barbarism that man is able to exercise was maybe nowhere near the pro, or, you know, it may have been less, if not just the same as now. Maybe that's something that's actually constant. However, I would argue the very structure of the society probably led to the curtailing of such excesses, probably more so than it does now. Rather, some increasingly rare private slavery and serfdom have been replaced by a near universal system of public tax slavery and serfdom. As well, wars have not disappeared but only become of a larger scale, and as of excessive punishments and witch hunts, they have not gone away either. To the contrary, they have multiplied. Enemies of the state are tortured in the same old gruesome or even technically refined ways. Moreover, countless people who are not murderers, thieves, libelers, adulterers, or rapists, i.e., people who live in complete accordance with the 10 biblical commandments and once would have been left alone, are nonetheless routinely punished today up to the level of lengthy incarceration or the loss of their entire property. Witches are no longer called that, but they are just the one sole authority in place. The identification of anyone as a suspect of evil doing or a troublemaker is greatly facilitated, and the number of people so identified is accordingly multiplied. And although such suspects are no longer burnt at the stake, they are routinely punished by up to lifelong economic deprivation, employment, poverty, or even starvation. And while the primary purpose of punishment was once restitution, the offender had to compensate the victim. The primary purpose of punishment today is submission. The offender must compensate and satisfy not the victim, but the state, thus victimizing the victim twice. Being broken on the wheel. I don't know, bring it back. That's all I'm saying. See, that's the real shame, is that ultimately this whole piece is trying to say that the medieval ages, they weren't this brutal time of horrendous punishments upon evildoers. However, I don't know, I think, I hope it is. I wish it was. And I want to return to that. And if that wasn't the case, then my God, we've been lied to. But it's nice here that he points out these sort of universal phenomena, that he's sort of subtly suggesting that witch hunts didn't go anywhere. We just call them by something else different. And because we no longer call them witch hunts, in that simplistic sort of sense that the common man or the public sees things, that label itself carries the value with it, not the action. So you can engage in the action of witch hunting, but as long as you call it cancel culture, then carry on, do as you please. When we can state when with this we can state a first conclusion. The present democratic social order may be technologically most advanced civilization, but it is most certainly not the most advanced socially. As measured by biblical libertarian standards of social perfection, it falls far behind the Middle Ages. Indeed, as measured by those standards, the transition in European history from the anarchic medieval to the modern status world is nothing less than transition from a God-pleasing to a godless social order. At various places, in the most condensed form in my essay From Aristocracy to Monarchy to Democracy, I've analysed and tried to reconstruct the process of decivilisation, which has by now been going on for half a millennium, and explain the calamitous and deleterious consequences and ramifications that it has had for the development of law and economics. I shall not repeat or recapitulate any of this here. Rather, I only want to shed some light on the principal strategy that all statists from late Middle Ages on until today have pursued to reach their statist ends, so as to also gain, if only indirectly, some insight into any possible counter-strategy that could lead us out of the current predicament. Not back to the Middle Ages, of course, because too many permanent and irreversible changes have taken place since, both in regard to our mental and material conditions and capacities, but to a new society that takes its cues from the study of the Middle Ages and understands and knows of the principal reason for its demise, the Industrial Revolution and its consequence have been a disaster for the human race. That's the answer, Hopper. That's all you need. The strategy was dictated by the quasi-libertarian stateless medieval starting point, and it suggested itself, naturally, first and foremost to the top ranks of social authority, in particular to feudal kings, In a nutshell, it boils down to this rule. Instead of remaining a mere primus inter pares, you must become a solus primus. I obviously didn't know this because I've never been taught Latin in my life, but that is the general idea of going, you know, one amongst a leading few to a sole leader, in the sense that, you know, no longer is some leader willing to compete as part of these different entities and these guilds and what have you. He instead has to be the solus primus. He has to be the one that you have to go to. And to do this, you must undermine, weaken, and ultimately eliminate all competing authorities and hierarchies of social authority, beginning at the highest levels of authority with your most immediate competitors and from there on down, ultimately to the most elementary and decentralised level of social authority invested in the heads of individual family households. You, every statist, must use your own initial authority to undermine each and every rival authority and strip away its right to independently judge, discriminate, sentence and punish within its own territorial limited realm of authority. Essentially what he's talking here is the theory of sovereignty, and sovereignty being carried from the patriarchs to local lords to heads of churches to ultimately the absolute kings, which I don't think is inherently the problem. But as you force this sovereignty upwards, if you do so by attacking and destroying and otherwise subsuming the other secondary institutions in society, then you will produce a total and very singular and uniform society, and the sort of mass and total society that we have nowadays is the direct product of this process continuing on and on and on. Kings other than you must no longer be allowed to freely determine who is another king or the next king, who is to be included or excluded from the rank of kings, or who may come before them for justice and assistance, and likewise for all other levels of social authority, from noble lords and vassals as well as separate local communities, orders, associations, and ultimately all individual family households. No one must be free to autonomously determine his own rules of admission and exclusion, that is to determine who is supposed to be in or out, the conduct to expect of those who are in and want to remain in good standing, and what member conduct instead results in various sanctions, ranging from disapproval, censure, and fines to expulsions and corporal punishment. The sort of final, the fat end of the wedge, as it were, for this is the civil rights agenda, the complete and utter suspension of poverty rights and the sovereignty of the common man, his ability to defend his own castle, as it were. How to accomplish and centralise all and consolidate all authority in the hand of a single territorial monopolist, first an absolute monarch and subsequently a democratic state, by enlisting the support of everyone resentful of not being included or promoted in some particular community, association or social rank, or of being expelled from them and unfairly punished. Against this unfair discrimination, you, the state or would-be state, promise to get the excluded victims in and help them get a fair and non-discriminating treatment in return for their binding commitment to and affiliation with you. Anyone that's been around for the couple of streams and towards the end of the year and towards the start on San Francis, and particularly when we went over the essay Equality as a Political Weapon, will instantly recognise what's going on here. He's describing the sort of zero-sum understanding of political behaviour, in which you cannot generate value in society through politicking in any way. You can only attempt to destroy or move value from one group to another. And if you campaign for a group that has in some sense less value, whether for real reasons or not, you can engage in some sort of societal change by getting those people under you as public support, so that you can then distribute whatever values in society back to them. Or maybe you don't even do it anyway. Which is always the great trick. On every level of social authority, whenever and wherever the opportunity arises, you encourage and promote deviant behaviour and deviance, and enlist their support in order to expand and strengthen your own authority at the expense of all others. This is a point someone was making in a group. We were discussing stuff the other day. The people who sit the farthest outside of societal norms become the very same people who have to demand human rights, because they, their behavior isn't supported or proliferated in the trends of society. So if you're someone who wants to increase the number of rights and legal guarantees in general, as I say, and you would want to promote deviant behavior so that you can argue in a defense of it, and furthermore set up some form of institution within society that holds up this defense and allows you some other new political avenue for power. Accordingly, the principal counter strategy of re-civilization then must be a return to normality by means of decentralization. The process of territorial expansion that went hand in hand with centralization of all authority in one monopolistic hand must be reversed. Each and every secessionist tendency and movement then should be supported and promoted, because with every territorial separation from the central state, another separate and rival centre of authority and adjudication is created, and the same tendency should be promoted within the framework of any newly created separate and independent territory and centre of authority, that is, any voluntary membership, organisation, association, order, club, or even household within the new territory should be free to independently determine its own house rules, its rules of inclusion, of sanctions, and of exclusion, so as to successfully replace the current status system of forced tutorial and legal integration and uniformation with a natural, quasi-organic social order of voluntary, territorial, and legal customary association and disassociation, which is always the important part that gets forgotten. I mean, the virtues and the civic education and making the public entirely retarded can be seen in the fact that they don't see freedom of association having the corollary of disassociating. They can't see the link between the two. It doesn't exist to them. You have to go through the lengths of explaining what property rights are and a whole host of other things before they can even begin to click that, oh wait, the Civil Rights Act didn't just put people together, it also forced people together, because it didn't give them a choice to say, well, if you don't want to mix, you don't have to. Moreover, as an important addition, in order to safeguard this order of increasingly decentralized centers, ranks, and hierarchies of natural social authority from internal corruption or external foreign attack, each newly re-emerging social authority should be encouraged to build as wide as possible a network with similarly placed and like-minded authorities and other foreign territories as jurisdictions for the purpose of mutual assistance in case of need. Right, whew, I'm glad we actually managed to get through all of that in 90 minutes. I didn't think I would. Now, believing the other half of this essay, where he discusses Steven Pinker's The Better Angels of Our Nature for next Monday, I think there is a possibility Peter Aquinas may be joining me for that. However, there is no guarantee at this moment. I think there is one sort of final point I would like to look at this in general, though. And that the values you have prior to you viewing history, whether or not values are imbued purely out of the view of history or not, is possibly a slightly different question. But that those values, say for example, if one of them is egalitarianism, if you genuinely believe that all men are one and the same, and that we should all stand on the same authority and the same sort of respect and recognition from society, that to see people in the past who were kings or lords or community leaders who were honest about the fact that, compared to the rest of society, I am some greater person and I can provide more than my, is that person's involvement in society that allows it to be greater than sum of its parts, and allows something like the division of labour to actually take hold. And that very process of civilization as opposed to de-civilization or re-civilization, as Hopper then refers to it. That process gets totally pushed to the wayside because at first these people balk at the idea that, well, you can't be a king. You can't say you're any greater than your fellow man. That doesn't stand up to the egalitarian standards of modern day. And they engage in a very anachronistic sort of rearwards view. It becomes no wonder that so much of that history, in a period where there is very interesting things to learn about sovereignty. And again, I would recommend Patriarcha from Robert Filmer, where the discussions around social contract theory, even at the time, there were people who sat and looked at social contract theory and thought, this is all rubbish. What a load of absolute dross. Even then, they were still fighting this same problem of liberal theory or liberal social science, the understanding of the world as it was being applied without the understanding of the world as it was, which I think it becomes such a kind of integral problem. And again, you come back round to the issues with the IDW. And even when in their sort of sharpest form, as someone like a Jordan Peterson, when he takes all his love of capitalism and liberalism and freedom, he struggles to root them in anything other than the goodness of man, in some sense, or the commonness of the agreement, the goodness of man, or some weird sentiment like this. Because if he was to truly turn round to God, or if he was truly to turn round to the West, there would be the implicit statement that it is not pluralistic. That, as John Locke recognised, that to him, the blank slate, as much as that's a problem, the blank slate only applied to white Christian men, not anyone else. And that the white Christian men were equal to one another, which is a recognition that, recognizing, sorry, that other societies do not conform to this structure that we seem to have formed to over the course of the Middle Ages, where we did brew a high trust society. And I noticed right at the end of the last bit of Deepest Lore, I caught that the conversation become about queuing, and queuing is a British phenomena, and that even when there's nothing pointing to the fact that where and when you should queue, people will still do it, and specifically British people will still do it. And that people from other societies do not have this sort of respect for one another. It's not first come, first serve, it's first come, first take, which is a very different thing. But the IDW becomes, as I said, rootless. It can't hold on to some form of authentic Christianity, or an authentic, to use a weird term, an authentic Westernism, because to do so would be to step outside of the bounds of liberalism purely justified by man. And I've noticed I'm already getting to the point where I may be starting to re repeat myself. So, unless there are any incredibly pressing questions in chat, which I'll give a minute or two to come in, I would just say that later on this week, on Wednesday, I will be joining Academic Agent and a whole host of other people for a cigar stream on IDW rubbernecker in chief, James Lindsay, who's completely gone off the wayside, and who goes off the wayside because, in large part, he grounds his work around Steven Pinker's work, funnily enough. Other than that, I believe Scrump and Trig are planning a stream on Thursday. I might be joining for that. I don't know. We'll see when we get there. Other than that, all I will say is keep an eye out for writing on air Substack page, if I can grab the link for that. I think most people probably saw or viewed the sharing of the piece I wrote on representation the other day, which I felt all of a sudden there was that the Rings of Power thing came out right after I wrote that. I thought, so the simulation's breaking again. Oh yes, no, there are members of the IDW that are personally not people that should be trusted or looked upon as good. However, for the sake of engaging in intellectual sparring, hopefully by going through this and discussing some of the things that Hop is trying to highlight, that people can maybe see the difference between illiberalism proper and the modern sort of mealy-mouthed liberalism that doesn't really answer the questions that it should. I mean, it should be very simple. Can liberalism defend Western civilization? And if it can't, can it be modified to do so? And if it can't be modified to do so and still be liberalism as it can be recognised, then we need something else. So it's very interesting that as much as there is discussions of post-liberalism, at least on the right, there is no attempt by many of the liberal figures, funnily enough, of course, to develop something outside of that, or to develop something new out of it, and the tradition is very much left to the wayside to be mostly explained and educated to people by the Steven Pinkers of the world, the James Lindsays of the world, the John Petersons of the world, which get you maybe 65, 70% of the way there. But that last 30% that allows you to argue it as a total and absolute theory or worldview is non-existent in them. And therefore they leave you purely under the tack of the Marxism that they love to shoot at. Because the very Marxism they fight against can adopt the progressive positions that they hold and then say that, oh well, look, we're just the same. And all of a sudden, liberalism as it was becomes subsumed by communism and fascism, almost in a sort of sense as Dugin describes, I believe. But I think that is all, and I will go, as people can probably hear my voice cracking already. Thank you for showing up, and goodbye.